Have you done the practice at home or the instructions last week? I'd like to take this beginning as a little bit more informal time for you guys to hear from you and your concerns. Yes?
A comment at first. I've been doing meditation for so many years, Silva mind control, Siddha yoga, Ananda, just so many different kinds of visualizations. I really enjoyed last week really getting it about allowing awareness. It's for a compulsive doer, just allowing is delightful. My question has to do with duration of a meditation. For me to many meditations say, well, even if you do it for 5 minutes, that's good. Whatever you can do. Trying to do it right, part of me asks, well, it takes me half an hour to start getting down into the layer of feelings that you're referring to. I would think 45 minutes as a minimum. So this is the perspective on the duration is what I'm trying to ask.
It's a good question. One of the ways of approaching mindfulness practice. There's different. See, mindfulness is one way of looking at it. Is it's kind of like a tool, and there's many ways of using that tool, and many kind of philosophies to apply to it, many attitudes to have towards it, and the tool is relatively neutral. One of the purer ways. And that's a judgment, I suppose, to call it that way, of using a mindfulness practice, is to see that the is not to be interested in change, per se, but to be interested in simply the moment of mindfulness itself. And we tend to be very focused on change and the object, what we can know in awareness, and really want to somehow manipulate or change it or allow it or do something with it. And one way of doing mindfulness is what we're really doing is not so concerned. We're not really concerned about the objects of awareness. It can be whatever. It can be whatever. Just what we're concerned about is strengthening and developing the ability of the mind to know. The knowing is allowing awareness that may become really powerful and radiant. Also, in that kind of school of Vipassana, there's something very rewarding about any moment of mindfulness. If you're really confused and scattered. You can know it, you can be aware. Oh, confusion. And that moment is a little bit of light. So from that point of view, it doesn't matter if you sit 1 minute or 10 minutes or 10 hours. Because it's just your experience right now that you're having and your ability to be mindful of it. And it's rewarding in and of itself. However, as we do that, there is change. Even if we don't want change, there's change. And for one thing, that mindfulness practice pulls the rug from under all the momentum in our lives of non-acceptance, which is a lot. And when that momentum begins to crumble away or fall away, relax, then things start changing because we've built this kind of great structure of self based originally on this idea of not something we're not going to accept. And one of the things that can happen is we get settled. And we settle down to ourselves. We start settling below the normal street consciousness that we were kind of constantly distracted in and by, and then we often then as a kind of normal surface consciousness kind of surface distractions been quieting a little bit, then we get an increasing experience of intimacy and connectedness with oneself, and it can be very satisfying to have that. And so some people when they do Vipassana practice, they don't look at the reward of a moment of mindfulness. They see it a moment of mindfulness as a tool to get to that deeper state. So it's your choice. What's the purpose that you're putting mindfulness to? If you want that depth of intimacy, maybe you need to sit for 45 minutes. If you're content with a moment of mindfulness, all you need is a moment. Does that make sense?
Yes,
absolutely. And now the traditional way that this practice is taught in Buddhism, it's usually coupled together with a very strong concentration. because we want to be able to there is this kind of allowing awareness that's part of it, but it's coupled with concentration. And the concentration comes about a little bit from some kind of doing. So it's kind of like coupling allowing with doing and learning how to balance that. Because as we get more and more settled for the concentration, then we can see more carefully. And what we can see and be mindful of and not try to change, just allowing awareness, is very different when the mind is very concentrated than when the mind is very coarse. When you're very coarse mind, what you might be aware of is simply that you feel uncomfortable, perhaps. If the mind is really still, but you see underneath that discomfort, there's a tremendous amount of fear. And if you're even stiller, you might see that fear is connected to ideas you have about what you need. So really deep-seated ideas of what you need. And if you look even deeper, you might see that those ideas, what you really need, are just ideas. They have no foundation in anything except the world of ideas. Where did I get this idea that, I needed that? Or that I'm this kind of way? Many people in America have this idea that they're unworthy. And from that is a whole edifice. And then if you look more deeply, you start seeing deeper and deeper aspects of our experience. And when mindfulness practice is done in a Buddhist context, like a serious retreat, the subtleness and the concentration comes along with the allowing awareness. The allowing awareness kind of is like the allowing awareness becomes, if you give yourself enough time and space and silence and care to hold that allowing awareness, the samadhi kind of envelops it and couples with it. And then you can start seeing levels of what makes us run, what makes us tick, and levels of what is really deep in our nature in ways that are not accessible in normal street consciousness as we're walking about. Is this helpful at all? Yes?
Interested in what you just said about many people in America feel unworthy as if it is a cultural phenomenon here as it compared to elsewhere. And I wish you'd expand on that.
Well, I don't think I know a lot about this. I'm not a psychologist, but it's in my meeting with students and counseling people in meditation and all that, it's epidemic. I mean, my pick of people I meet, and so I don't know if I should extrapolate to all the rest of the people in America, but it's the people I meet, I attract them, I guess. And there's a lot of feelings of inadequacy, feelings of something fundamentally wrong with us before having done anything, feeling unworth and not being deserving of things is really common. And some people trace it to Western religious ideas like original sin and guilt that nothing to do with your... See, in Buddhism, the only reason anybody would be... from the Buddhist point of view, because Buddha wasn't American, the only reason why you'd ever be anxious about anything was if you had done something in the past that harmed someone. If you'd done, transgressed in some way, stolen from a bank or punched someone out, and then you feel anxious. But you don't feel, if you haven't done any transgressions, there's no reason to feel anxious about who you are. So, but in America, all these people are basically living good lives, and they're convinced that there's something really flawed about themselves. Something's wrong with me, I can't show people who I am, or I don't deserve, or I can't do it, or I'm inadequate, or... It's really prevalent. And there's a famous story, maybe it's been told too many times, of some psychologists, Western psychologists, talking to the Dalai Lama and asking him about the concept of, how in Tibetan Buddhism, how they work with feelings of unworthiness or self-hate. And it was all being done through a translator. And suddenly, he was asked this question about self-hate or something and unworthiness. And the Dalai Lama and the translator went back and forth in Tibetan for a long time. And it seemed like the Dalai Lama just didn't understand what was being asked. And finally he understood and he started crying. And he had no idea that there could be a culture where so many people were concerned with self-hate and self-loathing and self-criticism and self-feelings of inadequacy. And
it's not that way in India or...
They have other issues. So one of the interesting points about that then is the degree to which it is a cultural phenomena. And many of us take it very personal. It's all about me, you know, and we kind of in this little myopic world of me, and it must be really me that's wrong. And we realize, wait a minute, it's not so personal. It seems to come with the air we breathe in this culture for some people. Yes, please.
Last week I was just doing the practice. A question started coming up about kind of surrounding emotion and attachment and a sort of. I guess I was wondering if you had any comments on differences, say, between kind of passionate concern and a Christian charity kind of idea versus the compassion kind of idea that you had mentioned. I'm just wondering if terms of emotion seems to lead naturally in a sense to attachment.
That's the thing that Buddha says. It doesn't lead naturally to attachment. It just commonly does. And the whole point of Buddhist practice is so that it doesn't lead to attachment. And we have to be very careful that when Buddhists use the word attachment, they mean clinging tight. They don't mean attachment parenting or often we kind of use it very lightly in the West. You know, someone says, well, I'm attached to my child or my child's attached to me. It just basically means there's love or bonding, and which is healthy. There doesn't have to be attachment, and there doesn't have to be attachment or clinging in our emotional life and our compassion in order for us to act with passion. You can act with tremendous enthusiasm and fueled by wisdom and compassion and get things done. One of the things that's very challenging for some people to realize is that there can be forces of motivation within us which are not based on anger, hate, greed, or lust, you know. And there are some people who defend, for example, anger, because I get a lot done when I get angry. And it's nice to get a lot done, but you can get just as much done with very powerful motivation of compassion as you can with anger, and probably with a lot much more benefit to others than yourself. Does this address your concern? Okay, so let's sit. So begin by taking an alert but comfortable posture. In particular, letting your spine be a little bit more upright, lightening the vertebrae by pulling them up a little bit. Gently closing the eyes. And then taking a few deep breaths. And as you breathe out, relaxing around that alert spine. Letting your breath return to normal. And then taking a few moments to scan your body to see if there's any obvious places of tension or holding that you can let go of. In the forehead. The eyes. Jaws. letting the shoulders be a little bit softer. Letting the shoulder blades be a little bit heavy and settling down the back. In particular, it's useful to let the stomach be soft. Let the stomach hang forward, perhaps. Partly so that a broader stomach makes a better foundation for the rest of your torso. And then bring an allowing awareness to your experience of being in a body. Just in a very generous way, just to feel your embodied experience in whatever way it shows itself. Seeing if you can relax your mind a little bit so the body is just left alone in the field of awareness. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of your body's experience of breathing. The experience of inhaling of exhaling And when we first sit down after a busy day, there may be many thoughts and concerns that continue from the day. To the best of your ability, put them aside. But if you can't put them aside, just let them be in the background and bring a devoted attention to the simplicity of breathing, letting yourself become simple as you breathe in and out mindfully. Whenever you notice your mind wanders off in thinking, Be relaxed about that. But when you notice you're wandered off in thought, let the experience of breathing return to your awareness. Beginning to center your awareness in the experience of breathing. And the mind wanders off in thought repeatedly or with strong concerns. Before you let go of them and come back to the breathing, see if you can relax those thought concerns. Relax any tension in the body connected to that kind of thinking. Forehead, temples, jaws, shoulders. Notice if you're having any thoughts about your practice itself, about what's going on in your body, your breath, your attention. judgments about how well it's going. You can let go of all of those. Any thought of judgment or evaluation about the practice, you can let go of. And return to the simplicity of mindfully breathing in and out. If some strong body sensation is compelling, makes it difficult to be with the breathing, bring an allowing awareness to that. Hold it. Sometimes it's useful to think of awareness as being a room, a very, very large room. And when you meet some strong sensation in the body, you're giving it lots of room. Just to feel it and sense it. Not to push it away or want it to be different. And now you can let go of paying attention to your breath. And very subtly, if you can, start noticing the quality of the voice that thinks. What you think about is not important. But if and when you do happen to think, notice if that voice is soft or loud in your head, harsh or gentle, hesitant, or racing ahead, kind or mean, fast, slow, calm, agitated. As if you're listening to someone else speak and you're paying attention to the tone of their voice. What can you notice about the tone of your voice as you think? It's best not to strain at this exercise, but kind of and then investigate and see when thoughts and thinking arises, are there any emotions that seem connected to your thinking? And if there are, bring an allowing awareness directly on that emotion. Not to push it away or make it different, but simply to hold it there in the great room of awareness, to see it clearly. As the thoughts pass through your head, are there any body sensations connected to that? We think hard, we frown sometimes, or we tighten the eyes or the jaws. Certain kinds of thoughts manifest as pressure, agitation, energy. Can you notice any energetic or physical aspects to the process of thinking? And then in the next couple of minutes, return again to your breathing, feeling the breath, sensing it, resting the attention there. But every time your mind wanders off in a thought or a thought arises, simply name it, thinking. Clearly see it and name it for what it is, and then return to your breathing. How easy is it for you to clearly see a thinking when thinking's occurring? Does it camouflage itself? And then notice what happens to your thoughts, your thinking, when the sitting comes to an end. So, our thinking, our thoughts, maybe it doesn't need to be said, are a very important, almost central aspect of many people's lives, maybe all of our lives. And being a very central, for many people, they sometimes are invisible. It's kind of like we don't see the air we breathe, or supposedly a fish doesn't see the water it swims in. It's kind of like the element that we swim in often is our thinking and our thoughts. And I meet people periodically who get introduced to this practice, and they say that they never notice that they're thinking. They don't know how to notice. They're not aware of it. Somehow We're so easily pulled into the world of thinking that it's sometimes very, very easy to lose ourselves in the world of thoughts. And there's no self-reflection, awareness, this is what's going on. Many people, it never occurred to them you're supposed to be, or you could be aware of your thinking. Your thinking is supposed to just go along merrily, happily, along forever, whatever way it wants. And we're supposed to, and then many people identify with their thoughts. One of the common places where people, either consciously or some kind of semi-consciously, take to be themselves is their thinking. I am what I think. I am what I, you know, I think, therefore I am, is the great expression. And even though some people might say, well, I know that I'm not my thoughts, we operate often as if that's the case. In the sense that we often, many people believe their thoughts. It's my thought, after all. You know, I'm always right. It's my opinion. There's a way in which we identify so strongly with our thinking, we often take them to be not only believable or true, but often we take them to be an accurate representation of what we're thinking about. One of the little cliches or little teachings that have come down over the last 30 years in the Vipassana circles comes from an Indian teacher who once said to, maybe it was Sharon Salzberg, said something. He said, thoughts of your mother are not your mother. And that helped. Because we often relate to our thoughts about things, how we think about things. And what we think about things is not the thing. Many of us have been in situations where we've been categorized. Someone has seen us in a particular way. They have some idea of who we are. And we feel very limited by that view. We're seen as someone's spouse, or seen only for our profession, or seen only as the person who made that mistake once. So you know, I'm more than that. It's very easy to see how other people limit themselves by the thoughts and ideas they have about themselves. And we see, wait, there's much more to you than that. But it's very hard for us to see how we do it to ourselves, how we have these ideas and thoughts, and how it's not actually an accurate representation or image, often, of what we think about. But we think, you know, that this is the way things are. The thoughts of my mother are not my mother. I remember when I was in my early 20s doing a lot of Zen practice, for some reason I had some occasion to talk to my Zen teacher about parent-child relationships. And he said, you know, when a child growing up only knows the parent as a parent, but the parent knows themselves before they were a parent. They have a much broader understanding of who they are than the child does. And sometimes when a child, you know, gets to be an adult, it can be a little bit confusing when the parent, you know, returns to some of the other ways that they are, much broader ways that they are than just always the parent. So the thought of my mother is not my mother. The thought of what I'm thinking about is not necessarily the object of what I'm thinking about. We tend to believe our thoughts. So our thoughts often express or give word to our desires, our animosities and aversions. I like, I don't like. That person is such a person, this person is that person, this is what my needs are. And these ideas that flow through our thinking can go be quite invisible, but they can be the phenomenal revelation that you can let go of a thought. That you have some, we can develop some ability not to be driven by them or not to be caught by them. The image that's sometimes used is that you come to a train crossing and you stand there, wait for the train to go by, and all these wagons go by of the train, and you see one that's really interesting, so you jump on and you go, off you go to wherever the train goes. And that's kind of how it is with thoughts. The kind of thoughts happen, and then we see a really juicy one, and we jump on. and off we go. And it takes us a minute, 10 minutes, 10 years to get off that particular train. We get involved in our thinking, and if we don't see the fact that we're thinking, it's very easy to get caught by that, and off we go. And you might think, well, isn't that the way it's supposed to be? Not necessarily. It's possible to be free. It's possible to have to see as you're thinking and have some choice about what you're doing there. It's possible to not get involved. So the allowing awareness of mindfulness is an awareness that allows thoughts, but doesn't get on the train. Just it passes through. We don't get hooked by it. So many people have the association that meditation involves developing a silent mind, a mind with no thoughts at all. And then they get frustrated because they're thinking. In mindfulness practice, it can happen occasionally that the mind quiets so much that the person doesn't feel they're thinking, or they think they're not thinking, and they don't notice that was a thought. But it's not necessarily the point of mindfulness practice. The point is to develop this ability to know what's happening, to see what's happening, to have the allowing awareness. And the allowing awareness is kind of non-discursive. Can you almost say it's like a silent awareness of what's going on? So for example, you can think and you can know that you're thinking. You can think and not know you're thinking, which is mostly the case. So that little silent knowing, oh, thinking is happening. So a mindfulness practice, in that mindfulness practice is developing this allowing awareness. It's not hooked by anything. It doesn't get involved with anything. It just sees clearly this is what's happening now. We have no idea that we need to get rid of our thoughts or stop thinking. Our thoughts are just something else that we pay attention to, that we notice. If it's just kind of light chatter, then by all means kind of just relax and let go of it and come back to your breathing. But if it's more than just light chatter, then we bring our mindfulness and see it clearly for what it is. And it's actually possible to discover our freedom while we think, not instead of thinking. So I'll talk more about that, but I thought I'd stop now and ask you what your experience was when I gave you those exercises at the end of the sitting about paying attention to various aspects of your thinking, your tone of your voice, the emotional connection perhaps, the energetics of feeling in the bodies connected to it. What happened when you named thinking as it occurred? So who would like to offer some reports? Please.
I sort of get the idea of the thinking. I saw the thoughts, but I was wondering, you know, if I was only, my awareness was the thought itself, you know, being, and then the seeing was the thought of seeing something. That there's this place that you are where thinking is just like blood going around your body, and it's just, that's what it's doing, and yet, how does one make a decision that needs to come from a thought?
Well, you're allowed to think.
Um, know how to express it.
Yeah, and
I guess for me, a lot of times I have, you know, trouble with my decision making, and I see it come up, and I see the decision and the thoughts, and I can be as mindful as I can be at the time. But then what do I do?
How do you make a decision?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thought, so, I mean,
just... The thought comes up, I'm in the ice cream parlor, and there's strawberry ice cream and there's coffee ice cream. I like them both. How do I decide which one?
And then I could just say, I don't want any.
That's the third choice, yeah. And the fourth choice is to get both. There's lots of choices. So choice is a big part of it. Someone pointed out recently that modern, especially modern and maybe Westerners, Americans, have to confront more choices and decisions than anyone has ever done in the history of humankind. It used to be that, you know, you were born into a village and you knew what you were going to do for your life and what was going to happen, and you'd have to choose work, you'd have to choose where to live, you didn't choose what to do that day, you didn't choose a spouse, and you just did your life. It was kind of set for you. And we have all these choices, you know, let alone going into the supermarket. So the question of choices is very important for us. It's a good question. So how do you make a choice? I don't know if I'm addressing your concern, but one of the interesting places to look around if a person has trouble with that is to look at the feelings that are connected to that, the indecision, or feelings, the emotions connected to this decision making. Is there fear? And then maybe a person needs to look at the fear very honestly and directly before they can really come to this some kind of better understanding of the decision making abilities.
I do think of that at the time, and then there's not being sure whether just to face the fear or step back from it, and it just depends on my mood, you know, which way to go.
So how do you decide?
there's always like either or in a sense.
That's right.
You're going to do it or not.
That's right. There is. It's a really big issue, and maybe we'll talk about it some other time, but I think we should get back and just focus on thoughts rather than, if you don't mind. Yes, go back corner.
I was just to take off a little bit on what the fellow was just saying, but to keep her on thoughts. I noticed a similar difficulty in sometimes, you know, making decisions, but it seems to be an issue of trusting my thoughts, you know, because there's a sort of thought, emotion, desire cycle that goes on, and so when I consult those emotions, desires, and thoughts, they'll tell me one thing at one time, and it'll seem true, and then another thing at another time, and I guess in the process of meditation, I hope that when you talk about the sort of truer self, that, you know, that will emerge somewhat, and the clearer decision will be apparent, you know. And sometimes that happens, you know.
I think what happens as people do a mindfulness practice and get deeper in touch with themselves through mindfulness, they have sources of different reference points for making decisions. And places of greater integrity, places of understanding better the causal connections between things, a deeper understanding of what values and priorities we have, deeper understanding of our motivations in life and what's important for us. And so that gives us a whole, you know, different criteria for decision making than maybe the surface consciousness or the surface chatter would have, that's maybe kind of taken in a lot of the popular voices of our culture. But I'd like to hear about this meditation. I'd like to. this particular group seems to be a little bit shy about talking about, you know, the meditation experiences. Yeah.
The comment, pay attention to the tone of the voice, was wonderful, and you note the tone of, oh God, I'm whining. It so nailed it.
Great. It's good. Very good to see it. In Buddhism, we say it's better to know something, even though it's uncomfortable, than to not know it and let it continue happening in the unknowing.
What I did catch when you said that, it was probably, you know, too much layering on of words, was like, pretend it's in another language. Pretend you can't get the meaning and just listen to the sound.
Yeah,
like,
good.
Oh, I recognize that sound.
Great. I saw. Yes.
I was having a very peaceful, surprisingly peaceful meditation at the start, and up until the time this Rubik's Cube appeared on my screen. I mean, literally. Mm. Do you remember the Rubik's Cube? Well, I've never been able to solve that Rubik's Cube. And suddenly, my meditation went downhill from there. And I saw my hands on the Rubik's Cube, and I was twisting it and turning it, and I was gone. I was lost. And for the next, I don't know, that happened very early in the meditation. And then when you asked about the tone of my thoughts were very aggressive after that. They were very directed toward, you know, certain things. And then I left that Rubik's Cube way far back and went on to bigger and better things. So it became very aggressive. And I one of the things I love about meditation, and one of the things I've learned, is that when I have those aggressive thoughts, my options in life become very limited. You know, I'm searching constantly to, I don't know, to bring them to life, you know. And you also asked about thinking about thinking. There were times when I could sit back and just be like, oh, there you are, trying to fix that Rubik's Cube. And other times I was right in there.
Mm-hmm. What was the difference between just noting it and versus being right in it?
What was the difference?
Yeah.
It was much more peaceful to sit back and almost comical than note it. You'd be like, ugh, there's that Rubik's Cube. And as opposed to being in there and being like, that Rubik's Cube.
Thank you very much, yes.
When you asked about the tone, at first I could say, oh, you know, it's calm and gentle and some of those terms. And then you said, well, what would someone, something about what would someone else look at it and see? And, oh, that changed it. Then it was meddlesome and gossip. And the thing is, both of those were true, which is kind of weird.
Yes, please. You're back.
The comment that you made about listening to the tone is useful to me too, and also brought me back to things you said earlier. For me, it was noticing this sort of sense of urgency and anxiety about, did I do the right thing? Am I going to make the right choice? You know, could I have done something differently? And that's a lot of tells of sense of where my thoughts are coming from. And I realize that what you said about having so many choices is an interesting thing to think of in terms of your observation about people being so anxious about not being worthy and not somehow being lost. Because I think a lot of the choices you make, it really doesn't matter if you make this choice or that choice. There are choices, there are moral choices that we face that are really important. I mean, it's a right thing to do sometimes and a wrong thing to do. And a lot of the things that I think all the anxiety noises about in our culture are very trivial things. And to recognize that you can't know what the outcome is, so you have to make at some point act, and either there's not a right thing or a wrong thing to do in a lot of cases.
Great. Thank you very much. Yes?
I've had a lot of thoughts, and they have had a feeling of being asleep. I don't think I was really asleep, but I would have thoughts for a while, and then it would be like waking up and going, oh, I'm sitting in the meditation hall, I'm supposed to be listening to my breath, or, oh, Bill's talking. And I can't even remember what all the thoughts were about. So it really is, in a way, it's like I was asleep, but I swear I wasn't. I was thinking.
Well, kind of flushed.
I had a similar experience. My thoughts were very random. They weren't dreamlike. But when I would notice that they were there after a moment, I would say, where did that come from? And go back to the breathing.
Okay.
It was like that waking up, but not, I didn't fall over.
Thank you. I saw a hand over here. Over here? Yes.
It's such a wonderful question. Just to ask what the tone is so simple, and yet I've never thought about it. And to tell you the truth, I'm surprised. I haven't read a lot of meditation books, but I've read a couple. And I'm surprised that I've never seen it posed in a meditation book. I think it's a wonderful question because and you're talking about your thinking is sometimes like the air you breathe, and you take it for granted and you don't step back and notice your thinking. Well, I find is until you pose the question, I never really stopped to think about what the tone of my thinking generally is. And I don't know if you would agree, but and maybe I'm generalizing from my own experience onto others, but I sort of agree that most of us, with exceptions, of course, but most of us, most of the time, have a prevailing tone to our thinking, because most of us are character types of one sort or another. I thought it was a very interesting question to step back and think, and just think about what is my thinking like? Where's the tone of my thinking most of the time? If you really can answer that question, it can tell you an enormous amount about yourself.
Mm-hmm. And certain kinds of thoughts are different tones, different voices. And you might also ask, whose voice is that? And occasionally you might find a certain kind of common theme, maybe is a certain parent's voice or someone you've internalized. It's fine to have a tone to a voice. It's what's pointing to is the opportunity to notice it. What about when I asked about the physical sensations or the energetics or the pressure or tension connected to thinking? Was that something anyone could notice? Or were you so calm by that time? Yes.
Well, as I was noting my thinking, I realized that I was thinking about things that had caused a lot of anxiety during the day. So the thought was going back to the anxiety, and what I noticed was a very, very tight jaw. It was just almost painfully tight. And I said, oh my God, I hadn't noticed that. Where did that come from? So, and it was directly tied to that thought.
Uh-huh. Great. So. Anybody else see a connection between some physical sensations and their thinking? Yes?
Extremely sharp pain between my shoulder blades. So I thought, well, I'll just sit here and be with this sharp pain. But then I can't imagine sitting with pain for a long time because I just started getting more and more agitated. And my stomach started clenching. I felt like running out of here screaming, So by the time you rang the bowl, I was just sitting there.
It's possible to have a lot of equanimity around pain. We tend to be very reactive to physical pain. We don't want it, we hate it. We have a lot of judgments about it. We have a lot of interpretations about it. Just plain old aversion to it. And all those reactions and responses are actually optional. And a lot of the process of negotiation, mindfulness with pain, is to see how they're optional and begin separating ourselves from it, or letting go of it, or just not letting it run the show. And it's possible to sit with a tremendous amount of pain and be very peaceful. Agitation and pain are not necessarily wedded together. So, but your experience is quite common for someone who's new to this and has never really learned to work with their pain. That's almost the natural response, is to get agitated and stuff. And if you find yourself getting agitated too, you know, a lot, then you might want to just break the posture. You know, you don't want to, you know, if you're tying yourself up in knots, then, you know, lean over or shift or something. Yes?
When I meditate often, and particularly tonight, I feel like my body temperature becomes higher and higher, that I just feel really overheated. And on the day that you did the meditation speech of St. Mark's, there we did a longer meditation. I think it was longer. And I noticed that it went up, and then it changed at some point and started coming back down, which didn't happen tonight. Tonight it kept going up to the point that I started to feel some anxiety. You know what? Have you ever heard of
this? Oh, sure, I've had that.
You have
that? Yeah, and other people have that. It's not uncommon. Nothing to worry about. What's interesting is for you is just to be aware of it. Oh, temperature going up. Oh, mm-hmm. Thinking about temperature going up. Oh, getting anxious that it'll never come down.
Yes.
Anxious.
Yeah.
Just being, oh, that's what's going on in the present moment. Oh. You know, that's all we need to do, is just be aware of what's going on and try not to get on all those wagon trains, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Just let it be. But that's going to happen for a number of different reasons. The temperature can go up. Sometimes the temperature goes down a lot and people get quite cold.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a function of the practice and nothing to worry about. Yes, please.
What if it's not that you're uncomfortable, but you just keep moving around a lot and feel really distracted?
Yeah. Okay, I'll talk more about this now. So, what I was trying to get across, one of the things I was trying to get across here to you, is that there's other things to pay attention to when you think, besides the content of our thoughts. Usually that's what attracts us to our thinking, is the content, what we're thinking often. It's really important what we're thinking. And when we focus on, usually if we can focus on our thoughts, most people start focusing on what we're thinking about. There's other things going on in the event of thinking. It's a whole process, it's a larger event than just the content. And so there's a tone of the voice, there's the energetics connected to it, there's the physical sensations and tightening connected to it. There's the emotions that might be connected to it. It's a larger event. And one of the ways to be mindful of thoughts without being caught by them and getting involved with them is start noticing the wider field of what actually makes up a moment of thinking. And if you can connect, for example, to the physicality of it, or to the tone of it, or to the emotion connected to it, then you're not connecting to the story. And the story is what is so enchanting and seductive. And you know that story, you know, how I'm gonna, what I'm gonna say to so-and-so, and what I didn't say, and you know, and analyzing what happened and what's going on, planning tomorrow. So we want to bring mindfulness to thoughts. So this is how it works in practice. In mindfulness practice, we're basically emphasizing the breath as a place to develop the mindfulness and develop some calm and settledness, until something else becomes compelling, makes it kind of difficult to be with the breath. When you start feeling some tension, or because something else is really wanting your attention, you don't have to live with that tension. Just forget about the breath and bring your meditative awareness to that other thing that feels compelling. If it's strong for sensations in your body, develop a meditative awareness on those sensations. And there's underscored meditative awareness, not a reactive awareness, not a judgmental awareness, just an allowing awareness that sees it clearly and begins to differentiate between the actual experience in the body and all the reactions and thoughts and interpretations that might go on in the mind. If it's an emotion that arises, then we bring an allowing awareness to the emotions if they're quite compelling. See them clearly. Feel them in the body. Let the body be the container for the emotions. So give lots of room to the emotions to be there. In meditation, we talk about giving complete permission to have whatever emotion you know happens to come up. Just don't dredge anything up. And once they come up, allow it to be, as opposed to getting involved with it. And probably if you're novice at this, you won't see the difference. You won't see how quickly we get involved. But as you start bringing more mindfulness and attention, you start seeing all the ways in which we get involved, get hooked by it, get onto that wagon train, and off we go. Now, same thing with thoughts. When thoughts arise, and if they're just kind of wandering thoughts, we find ourselves having drifted away, then usually just relax, let go, and begin again with your breathing. It doesn't matter how many times you have to come back to your breath. Just the important thing is to come back, to remember to come back. However, sometimes the thinking is more compelling than that. It's not just kind of a light wandering mind that wanders off, but there's some stronger concern. If you came in here today to meditate and your boss had just fired you, probably the intensity of your thinking is a little bit stronger than if you came in here after a nice holiday and relaxed and everything looked fine in your life and you're calm. So there's different levels of intensity of our thinking, different levels of involvement depending on the strength of it and our involvement with it. So if you notice that it has more power, and even, for example, one way it has more power is we keep rethinking the same thing. We can let go of it easily enough, but then 2 seconds later, it's the same thought, the same kind of thinking. Then we need to take a more careful look to it, bring more kind of attention to it. If it's a very recurring thought, then you might want to look at what is the emotion that seems to be giving the fuel to the reoccurrence. People who plan a lot, which is a common enough occurrence, they sit down, they close their mind, they enter into a deep, phenomenal, deep, quiet, calm stillness for about a tenth of a second, and then they start planning the day. And then they return to this phenomenal depth of samadhi, or this time a 20th of a second, and then they're off planning the day again. There's a lot of planning. Often for people, there's an underlying emotion of fear, apprehension, anxiety, which is actually prompting those thoughts. And no matter how many times you notice, oh, planning, planning, thinking, thinking, if you don't notice the underlying factory for them, the factory will keep producing. So if you have a very recurring theme in your meditation, drop down into your body and see what is the emotion that seems to be the source of this, or the fuel for it. And then bring your meditative allowing awareness to that. And if you feel that, then there's no reason for there's usually no reason for them to produce thoughts. It's kind of like thoughts are sometimes a symptom, like a flag saying, hey, you dummy, there's something that needs attention here. And it's not the thoughts, it's the feeling. Of anxiety, of fear. If thoughts are, if they're difficult to let go of them, if they're kind of very strong and just insistent, then you want to bring a very clear mindfulness to them. Just really kind of turn your attention to them and just note, thinking, thinking. If it's very obvious what kind of thought it is, you can note planning, planning, remembering, remembering. Just call it for what it is. And really look at it clearly. And sometimes when we look at thoughts clearly, we're no longer caught by them. And that's what we're looking for in meditation, is not to be caught by something. Not necessarily to get it to go away. But if we're not caught by thoughts, they usually don't have any more fuel. Because they're fueled by our involvement with them. And they kind of naturally pass away often. I make a distinction between thoughting and thinking. Thoughting is just a function of the mind. It's what the mind does. It makes thoughts. Thinking is when we get involved with those thoughts. A juicy thought comes up, and then you start thinking about it, all those chain of associated ideas. One is leave it at the world of thought. Thought comes up, we just let it be. So part of what we're learning to do is to kind of let things be as opposed to get involved and get hooked by things. So to take a, you know, just look clearly, oh, I'm thinking right now, recognize it. And we're not really interested for the purposes of meditation about the story you're thinking about, the ideas you're thinking about. And that's very hard for some people to uncouple themselves from. It can be very important to do that. And one of the ways, you know, I should maybe back up a little bit and erase what I said. Actually, there are two ways of doing mindfulness of thoughts. One is to actually pay attention to the content. And for some people, it's phenomenally powerful to do that because they had no idea that what they were thinking. Or they might know the surface of their thoughts. They might know what they want. But there's subtle thoughts which kind of support the surface thoughts. And if you start paying attention to the thoughts, you might see the cognitive patterns that motivate us, that drive us, the beliefs that we have, the assumptions we have. Unexamined assumptions and beliefs about ourselves, about others. So one way of doing mindfulness is just actually to look at the content. And that often will set people free because they often it's unexamined. Gives us a chance to reevaluate. To use mindfulness in meditation, normally we don't engage ourselves at all with the story or the content what we're thinking about. And it can be a great relief to know you don't have to be involved. All we want to do is to notice that we're thinking and see that clearly enough that we're no longer hooked by it and caught up by it. We're not trying to get rid of our thoughts, but we want to see it clearly. Now, one of the ways not to get caught by the story is start noticing some of the other features of thinking besides the story. To notice the tone of the voice. As soon as you might notice a certain kind of tone, you say, wait a minute. You know, is that how I want to live my life? Always with that kind of tone? It's very energetic. It's very exhausting. No wonder I have a headache at the end of the day. And maybe it's possible to relax that tone and have a quieter tone. Maybe to notice the energetics. If it's very powerful, compelling thinking, you might probably feel some kind of tension or pressure somewhere, tightening somewhere. In the forehead or the brow or the eyes and the temples. Maybe a band around the head, maybe pressure inside the brain, in the shoulders, in the neck, in the jaw, sometimes in the hands, in the stomach. Sometimes if you're very still, you can see a certain thought arises, and you can see that with that comes a tightening of the stomach. The more and more subtle your mind is in meditation, the more you see that there's always a connection, a physical connection with our thoughts. Thoughts, you know, they're produced out of the body. There's a physical aspect of it. But for subtle thoughts, you have to be very subtle in meditation to see the energetics of it. So sometimes just connecting to the bodily expression of it, how it feels in the body to have that thought. And that's a way of recognizing and being there for that event, but without being tripped up by the story, the content. Letting go of the story making. And then to clearly see it and then name it. Just, oh, thinking. Planning. Sometimes a very powerful way of kind of disengaging ourselves with it. It's like using a thought to create bigger room and not be caught by it. We name it, thinking. Now, on the side of paying attention to the content of our thinking, it's interesting to note what the common theme is. Because it's been my impression that for most people, one of the very common themes, maybe the most common themes, are either desire for pleasure, comfort, planning for it, wanting it, making it happen. Or they're self-referential. It's about me, myself and mine. How this relates to me. What I'm going to say, what happened to me, what I'm going to do. How other people are seeing me. It's quite amazing. And you'll see the power of self-referential interest in this little kind of way of talking about it. If someone went around, followed me around right next to me all day and talked to me as much as I talk to myself and repeated the same concerns as often as I repeat them in my mind, I would be begging them, if I'm, you know, if I keep my cool, begging them, asking them, please, shut up. I'd pay them to shut up. I'd be desperate after the 500th time that I planned the weekend. Don't you have anything better to do? But what's really amazing is that each time we have that thinking, usually, it's just as compelling and interesting as the first time when explore, you know, in our own mind. Why is that? I think part of the juice is because we're such creatures of self-identity, of how things refer to me, what it means for me. Now, one of the most fascinating things about, well, maybe it has to do with more deep meditation rather than what you can notice here, but is that the sense or the idea that I am anything, just that I am at all, is a thought. Who are you when you don't have the thought, I am? Have you ever thought about that? You ever felt that, discovered that? It can be quite a revelation to realize that you exist without having to think that you do, or to say, I am anything. So I hope, one of the things I hope to convey with this discussion around thoughts is how to maintain or how to try to develop the meditative awareness in the face of thinking and thoughts. Not to think of them as the enemies of meditation or the problems of meditation, but to see them as something else to bring into awareness. One of the principles of mindfulness practice is that there's no such thing as a distraction. And for practices that focus maybe on a particular technique or developing a certain kind of, you know, concentration practice, there can be distractions to that. But in mindfulness, whatever occurs is the food for further mindfulness practice, if you notice it. So you develop this great room inside of you, this great spaciousness, this great sense of allowing, that you can actually contain and allow anything at all. The most evil thought in the world can arise, and you're not caught by it. You don't start judging it or thinking that's terrible, how could I do that? You see it, you don't act on it, you don't do anything, just it floats up. You have the most saintly thought in the world, same thing. And it's really transformative to begin leaving ourselves alone, to leave ourselves radically alone. One way of describing mindfulness meditation is the radical practice of leaving ourselves alone. How often do you do that? Most of us don't do it hardly at all. If we do that, we set ourselves free. And also we get to know ourselves much better. So part of all this, you know, becoming more aware of our emotional life, our cognitive life, our embodied life, provides us an opportunity to get to know ourselves at a much deeper level than we can if we're always ignoring ourselves, not paying attention, racing ahead. It allows us a chance to settle on ourselves and be much more relaxed than you can normally be often in life. One of the surprises, I still feel kind of surprised by, I shouldn't after all these years, I'm more relaxed after my morning meditation than I am after I woke up from my night's sleep. You know, sleep doesn't provide the same level of relaxation as meditation can. So there's greater intimacy and self-understanding that comes. There's greater relaxation that's possible and ease. As we begin allowing ourselves to be who we are and create lots of room for that by developing the ability to see clearly, this is what's happening now, this is what's happening now. So as we do all this, and as you study, get to know your thoughts better and see them more clearly, and it might be important to remember this little saying. It's a blessing to be able to laugh at yourself, because then you'll never stop being humored. It's awesome, you know, it's just amazing what the mind does. And just allow yourself to be amazed, as opposed to judge it. Wow. Did you see what my mind did? Wow. Isn't that amazing? Like, it's kind of like if NASA sent up a probe deep into the cosmos, and there they saw, actually could see with the cameras they had with them on this probe, they actually could see a thought floating in space. No one had ever seen a thought before. Has anybody seen a thought? No one's ever seen one, right? It's like the first time, it's like, wow, a thought. And physically you can see a thought there. It would be like one of the most amazing things that humankind had ever discovered. And we would be in awe. Wow. It wouldn't matter if it was an evil thought or a good thought, you know, just wow. And here we are sitting with our thinking whatever you do, thinking about pizza and when's Gil going to stop talking or whatever we're thinking. And you know something? That particular thought is the pinnacle of 5 billion years of evolution. That moment is the pinnacle of 5 billion years of evolution. 5 billion years of evolution, it comes down to this feeling of inadequacy, this feeling of self-pride. Shouldn't you just be astounded and awe? I saw the photograph in the paper today of the Tyrannosaurus Rex in Chicago. Sue, did you see it? I was kind of in awe. When was the last time you were in awe that the evolution has produced this thought about pizza? So enjoy. The whole point is to have more enjoyment, more joy. So I talked a lot today, so we won't have our second meditation, and maybe we'll make up for it next week when we have the last class. Yes?
Last week was my first week here in some time. Are you taping these classes?
You talk to Allison, and these tapes are available for what you missed. So thank you. If you have any more questions, please stay behind and come and talk. I'm available.